The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org.
Thanks a lot for joining us here on The Pulse on CFRO, Leslie. Great to have you on.
Thanks for asking me.
So today we have another grim milestone set. This is the third month in a row with more than 170 deaths from overdoses. We hit 175 last month of people who have died. These are our neighbors, our friends, our families. Tell us your reaction to this next milestone this summer.
Well, of course, it's heartbreaking. First of all, it's heartbreaking. And having lost my son to overdose and knowing what that heartbreak is, I know that there's five families every single day out there feeling the same pain. So that's the first reaction I have to that. The second reaction that comes right after that is frustration and anger that we don't have a handle on this.
Yeah, you know, I remember reporting on this and interviewing you years ago when I was at 24 Hours and then Metro and the Tyee. And over the last six years or so, as we've talked, the numbers were slightly getting better, but people were very distressed about four people a day dying. And then we got it down to 3.5 and it hovered around there and was starting to get better. This just seems like such a setback to get to five.
Well, it is a setback. And obviously, it's lives we're talking about here. The response to COVID has been the driving factor in the uptick in deaths. But I mean, I don't like to conflate the two, the pandemic and the epidemic of overdose death, because they are different. But just as life would have it, the COVID response has effectively made the toxic drug supply even worse. And it also in the response, and which is rightly so, that we should socially distance, we should stay safe at all costs from COVID, has meant that many people who would access safe consumption services or overdose prevention sites are not using them. So there's a lot of factors that have gone into this increase in overdose deaths. It's really sad. And also the angry part of it for me is that the government is so slow to respond to this problem.
So, I mean, this is essentially saying that it's not COVID causing these overdoses, it's collateral damage of the way that we've responded to COVID. What is inadequate about the response in terms of drug users?
The government rolled out in March the safer supply for risk mitigation during COVID. And that was a good idea, but the way it was implemented was really inadequate. There was no infrastructure yet built behind this announcement. The way for people to access the safer supply was cumbersome, still is. There's an eligibility factor, there's an access factor, and also the drugs that were allowed during this risk mitigation were not necessarily the drugs that people need. So people were finding, even if they could access it, they were not getting enough to keep themselves from going into withdrawal, and they weren't the drugs that people actually necessarily are addicted to. So there was some real mistakes made in that rollout, and those have not yet been fixed. So out of there are about 55,000 to 100,000 people in this province who are addicted to illicit substances. Of that number, about 2,000 people have been able to access this safer supply. So that is obviously a drop in the bucket. And unfortunately, the people who aren't accessing that or aren't finding it adequate are still buying it on the street.
Now, the big news on Tuesday is your group has pulled out of the provincial committees that were consulting with you about the overdose response, alongside the BC Association of People on Opioid Maintenance and the BC Yukon Drug War Survivors. Why did you leave, and what did you leave exactly? What were you involved with?
Well, specifically, I've been involved with as a member of Mom Stop the Harm in many committees over the last 4 or 5 years. The one that sort of tipped the balance was the Overdose Emergency Response Center. We were all on those committees discussing. Primarily, we were discussing the problems with the rollout of the safer supply during COVID. What we found was that we were there and we were spending our time and spending our hours and spending or giving our wisdom on how this could be improved. And we were finding that nothing was being done. They weren't hearing what we were saying, or they weren't using that information to make the implementation better. That was kind of the last straw. And we decided to step back and to reassess our involvement with government. It's you know, we spend a lot of time and energy trying to educate the public, educate by being on media, by being in these committees. And it's very demoralizing, frankly, to not see what we say heard and used as part of the program. So we are asking, really, we're stepping back and we're asking for a meeting with the people who actually can make changes, or at least direct changes. And that would be Premier Horgan, Adrian Dix, Judy Darcy. We're asking for a meeting with those folks. And if we could have that meeting, we could find out what the problem is. What are the barriers? We could maybe find out the truth of why we are not getting the safer supply out there in a low barrier, accessible way for people.
It's a big move, obviously, to leave this committee. What are the risks of doing that in terms of losing access to the ear of government?
Well, the biggest risk to me is that they get our communication, our letter, and they say, well, we don't really care. And if that's the case, we have not yet heard back. We sent our letter on August 14th. We haven't heard a word back from those three individuals. And we're thinking that we won't. But with the numbers today, with the coroner's report, and with the incredible people who spoke during that report, who all to a person said safer supply is the answer to this problem, we're hoping that we would get some action from, or a response at least from government. If they say they don't care, if they don't get back to us, we'll continue to advocate, we'll continue to write letters to the newspapers, to government, to all levels of government, keep in touch. We'll continue to do what we do best. Hopefully, we hope that they value our input enough to actually come back to us with a sort of an offer of a meeting or an offer of a new strategy.
Now, Judy Darcy, the Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, put out a statement today saying that they are doing all that they can to prevent overdoses, and citing their doubling of youth treatment beds, the safe supply option for prescribers, working flat out to reduce overdose deaths since we formed government, she said. What do you respond to that, and what exactly is not enough? What needs to be done?
Well, first of all, the first point, actually, when she announced, when Judy Darcy announced that the ministry would be rolling out 123 new youth recovery beds over 1 to 3 years at a cost of $36 million. Honestly, I felt like it was a slap in the face. You know, not that that's a bad thing. We need to have recovery beds. We need to treat youth seriously. Obviously, we don't want youth addicted or dying. But what we needed rather than an announcement for 123 beds in 1 to 3 years is an announcement that says we're going to implement a wider, better, safe supply so people won't die. Nobody who dies is going to recover, obviously. So that sort of sidestepped the issue that we're looking for. The ministry and in the person of Judy Darcy has made several announcements. Another one was, I think it was about $10 million or just over $10 million for to support more safe consumption sites and more personnel, trained personnel to be there for people who use drugs. This is not, again, this is not a bad thing. This is a good thing. But again, it ignores the issue of safer supply, safe supply, which will stop the deaths, stop much of the need for safe consumption sites and all the other harm reduction methods that we have. We need them, no question. And yay, I'm glad we're getting, you know, more services that way, but not a word about safer supply. Other things, you know, the risk mitigation, safer supply, which was really is still stumbling along. And then before that, we had the announcement of the amendment to the Mental Health Act, Bill 22, which is fatally flawed. So all these announcements have come along, but they haven't addressed that one thing, a safe supply, a better, workable, efficient, practical, safe supply.
Are you hopeful at all about this new company that's going to be producing prescribed safe heroin that's run by our former provincial health officer?
I am. I'm very excited by that idea. And I hope that Dr. Kendall and his colleagues get the support they need for this. I mean, this is a bold step, but this is the kind of step that the government needs to look at and say, yes, here's a solution to access to the supply, which has always been one of the things that they have held up and say, well, we just can't get the supply of this drug. This is a big, bold step, and we support it 100%. I hope the government really does look at that and give financial support and give policy support or whatever is needed for this to go forward.
Do you think that the province has made some statements that they need some movement from the federal government to make these things happen? Is that something you think is actually necessary in terms of the criminalization aspect, the safe supply of heroin aspect?
I think that the provincial government can do a lot on its own. At this very moment, by a move by Premier Horgan, there could be a change to the Police Act that will effectively implement decriminalization. But I think also that the province needs to work closely with the federal government. They say they're doing that. There is, you know, I mean, a lot of the substances that people are addicted to are illicit drugs. So there needs to be changes in the exemptions. And so, yes, federal and provincial need to work together closely. But there are ways, and I am not an expert in this, but there are ways that a wider safe supply of, say, diacetylmorphine, which is heroin, and other substances that people are using, the stimulants and the benzodiazepines, which are like Ativan and so on, that they can be prescribed and rolled out to people who need them in a regulated, safe way. So I think it's political will. I think it's stigma. I think it's lack, like I said, I guess political will and courage need to just be stepped up especially by the provincial government. Mm.
I'm glad that you reminded our listeners that heroin's prescription name is diacetylmorphine and was once, in fact, prescribed widely, just as fentanyl is prescribed widely now.
Yeah, and actually that brings up another point, because fentanyl is used safely every day, thousands and thousands of times a day in a medical setting. Fentanyl, pharmaceutical fentanyl is not a dangerous substance if it's used properly. So that is another drug that is readily available, is cheap, and is certainly in the toolbox. Many drug users are wanting fentanyl, and that came out of really a lack of heroin on the marketplace. But if people want fentanyl as the drug that will keep them stable, then why don't we supply it? It's there. It is, like I say, it's around in every single medical setting you could find.
I'm engaged in this ridiculous series of debates on Twitter with, you've probably heard about the some of the residents, homeowners and condo owners in different neighborhoods are complaining about the police supposed inaction against people using drugs openly on the street. People saying that you know, they're endangering the safety of citizens, that there's people saying they should, the police need to act, that jail is the place for people who don't want to go into treatment. Do you have any words for people like this? I don't think we have many in our listenership, but if there's anyone listening who thinks these things, what do you say to them?
Well, I would ask them to be part of the solution rather than just addressing a problem that affects them personally. We all have to work together. I know I sound like Bonnie Henry, but we have to work together on this problem. The people that the police are harassing are likely people without homes. So, you know, it flows into other problems that we have as a society here in BC. There seems to be no compassion or understanding in people who are worried about the police in their neighborhoods and so on. That's one thing. The other thing is that addiction and drug use should not be a criminalized problem. That's why we call for decriminalization of people who possess personal amounts of illicit drugs. People shouldn't be going to jail. People shouldn't be harassed by the police. If there is an issue, that issue could be better addressed by someone who is more in the social services than in the criminal justice system. So I understand their fear and I understand the discomfort. But again, if we as a society can support people who use drugs in a better way, I don't think we'd have these situations.
I wanted to ask you a personal question, because this the treatment bed increase for youth, 123 new substance uses spread across the whole province, but it covers youth up to 24 years old. Do you think that your son Jordan would have benefited from that or any of these policies you're advocating for, since he died so young at 25?
He did go to a recovery facility when he was 19 on his own steam. I mean, he wanted to recover from addiction. It didn't actually work for him. He relapsed in a pretty short time. I'm not sure what the 123 beds would look like if they are evidence-based and provide the youth with all kinds of different pathways of recovery, then perhaps he would have. The one he went to, which I won't name, but didn't work for him. It was a 12-step program that works for some people, and it doesn't work for a lot of other people. So I am a fan of whatever we can do to keep youth safe, to keep them healthy, to help them recover. So it remains to be seen what these extra 123 beds, which is really just a drop in the bucket again, will look like. So I just hope that when they're scaling this up, that they're looking at the evidence, they're looking at what works, and they're giving the young patients a choice on what kind of pathway they accept. And also, I hope they involve families.
It sounds like, reading this announcement, that the youth treatment beds would be for substance use treatment and withdrawal management. So I'm guessing from substance use treatment, that would be the medically recommended Suboxone or methadone included, potentially. But it's unclear.
It is unclear. We don't know all of what they intend. But, you know, Suboxone and methadone are good drugs if they work for a person. If a person is heavily addicted, they may need to be tapering down on their drug of choice. There's so many pathways, but it all comes down to professionalism, evidence, and connection and support. I mean, there's a way to do it right, and there's a whole lot of ways to do it wrong, in my opinion. I'm not a expert in this, but just common sense tells you that youth need to be handled with velvet gloves, in a way, to keep them on the path of recovery. Kids, I mean, I know my son Jordan, when things weren't going well at the place he was, he walked out. And I didn't blame him when I heard the goings on there. I said, good, I'm glad you're home. Let's try and, you know, do this at home. And it did work for a while. But recovery is a long-term effort.
Leslie, thank you for sharing that. I talked to your colleague at Mom Stop the Harm, Tracy Letts, at the Overdose Memorial Rally. There was a big presence of your group. really helping de-escalate things with police, holding a vigil kind of at the side and showing their support. It was quite inspiring, I think, to people who at one point started chanting, "Thank you, moms, thank you, moms."
My son lives here in the downtown east side. I go to bed worrying about him every single night. And the overdose rate here in BC is just going up at an incredible rate. We need to band together and support everybody, all our organizations, to kind of push the government to do and change policy.
How does that feel to hear that kind of reception to your activities as parents?
Honestly, David, I was so proud. I just felt like, and these women did this. They are part of Moms Stop the Harm, but it wasn't like, you know, the board or any of us said, "Oh, go do this." They just took it on themselves. They reacted exactly the way I would hope. One of the successes of Moms Stop the Harm is that we are respectful, that we try to educate, we try to support the families. We're always courteous, you know, we're the moms, right? So to see their strength in this just it warmed my heart. I'm so proud.
And of course, it's not just for parents like yourself who have suffered loss, but for folks like Tracy, they may have children who are still in addiction or using and want to get them support and policy change.
Absolutely. I would say, I'm going to guess here and say about 80% of our our members of Moms Stop the Harm have lost a loved one, usually a child. But the other 20 or 25% are people like Tracy who have a loved one, a child in active addiction, needing the support, needing the infrastructure to keep them safe. And that's sorely lacking in this province as well.
Given that we're now at 5.6 deaths per month, the worst we've seen, do you feel discouraged about the 6 years of effort you've been putting into this battle? Or do you have any sources of hope?
I am sometimes discouraged. I'm sometimes just numb. I mean, it's really hard work to talk to families, to know what families are going through, to hear about deaths that could be prevented, to hear about stigma and so on. But those of us who work in this and who are invested in saving the lives of people who use drugs and supporting them, there's just no quitting. We can't quit. We won't quit until things make a very, you know, until there are some big changes here. Drug addiction and substance use disorder is a disorder. It's a medical condition, and it can be treated. So we can see the possibilities. We can see the light. We just can't quite get there. So no, we're not giving up, and I'm not giving up. We're in it for the long haul.
Thank you so much for joining us and also for sharing so much of your inspiration and story and actions with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care and stay healthy.
Thank you. You too.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.